Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. Dr. Woodard is on vacation this week. We all know people who have been deeply affected by the devastation of an ugly divorce. Almost every day I speak with people who share stories of their own parents' divorce and the toll it took on them as children. They all wish their parents had been able to manage this process in a healthier, more cooperative way. Divorcing well? Is such a thing even possible? My guests today are Anchorage therapist Whitney Whitman and family law attorney Jacob Sonneborn. And for those of you who are not familiar with me, I'm a licensed clinical social worker. I currently work as an individual family and marital therapist at Bridges Counseling Connection in Anchorage. On today's show, we will explore alternatives to the traditional divorce process, focusing primarily on the collaborative law approach to divorce. If you would like to join the conversation, we can be reached in three ways. You can call 1-550-8433 in Anchorage, or you can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752, or you can email questions or comments to line1@alaskapublic.org. You have to spell all that out for us, line1@alaskapublic.org. Jacob, Whitney, thanks for joining me today. I appreciate you being here.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you, Prentice.
Yeah, glad to be here.
All right. So today we're gonna touch on various topics of around divorce and some of the different approaches to divorce. But before we get started, I'd like to just get a little bit of background on you guys and kind of just quick snapshot summary of what you're doing these days and what your focus is. So Whitney, we can start with you.
I'm in private practice. I've been counseling in Anchorage for about the past 10 years. I started off in crisis and residential with teenagers, and I primarily work with teenagers and their families. I specialize also in self-injurious behaviors and self-sabotage in young women. And I really am interested in co-parenting work, and that's a lot of what I do now. So I've made my way towards working in collaborative law and helping people learn to co-parent in ways that are developmentally appropriate and healthy for their children.
Okay. Are you with a group? Or are you in private
practice? I'm in private practice. I'm a licensed professional counselor, and it's just kind of a one-woman show.
Okay, great. Jacob?
Thanks, Prentice. Again, thanks for having us. It's really nice to be here. I'm a practicing family law attorney. I've been practicing in Alaska since 2007. I grew up here, brought my family back up in 2007, and I've been at Ashburn and Mason, a firm here in town since that time, practicing primarily family law. Like Whitney, I think, just described, making attempts to get it to trend towards collaborative. It's not only a better process for the participants, a lot of times it's a better process for the professionals as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Collaborative law. We'll get to that a little bit later. It keeps popping up because it's what we like to do, and we're very... we have a little bit of a relationship, at least Whitney and I do. We should probably describe that. We go back quite a few years. I took a training with her, which was, I was like, who is this woman and why is she so fabulous?
Thanks.
And, her and it was Renee George, I think, was who's an APU professor. And she was one of the, you guys did, I forget what the training was on, but it was very good.
I'm sure it was very interactive.
Well, yeah, you put us in a lot of very uncomfortable situations.
Yeah, we like to do that.
We had to role play and show all our stuff out there. But
I think it was about working with parents, too. Maybe.
Probably something, parents, teenagers, something. And Jacob and I met for the first time at the, we were at the Alaska
Association of Collaborative Professionals
last week. So we met for the first time, and it's an exciting thing. And you said it's fairly new, or there's not, I guess, at least up here.
In Alaska.
So we're sort of embarking on a new sort of approach.
We Alaskans like to do that.
It's a, yeah, well, it was, you know, and I'm not going to probably get all these dates right. It started in the Midwest, a collaborative divorce approach started in the Midwest with an attorney by the name of Stuart Webb. And Mr. Webb basically got tired of feeling like he was a family law attorney. He got very tired of every day going in and feeling like he never knew which side the attack was going to come from, but he knew it was coming. And so he had this idea of if the courts could be removed from the divorce process, if that wouldn't make for a better process and one that was less stressful on the participants and less stressful on the professionals. So it's been around for decades in the lower 48. Shortly after I moved up, I believe it was in 2008, we had our very first collaborative training here in Alaska. And from that training, the Alaska Association of Collaborative Professionals was born. And it's been going on since then. And then we continually add new members like the two of you. And that helps, obviously, the practice grow and gives us great folks to work with, which is important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I talked to Whitney about it. She's like, you got to check out this collaborative law thing. And so I went off to Phoenix and did the training and signed up last week because I do think it is a really, really nice approach to a very difficult and challenging time in people's lives. So we're going to circle back around to that. Down the road a little bit, but I want to just talk a little bit about the traditional, quote unquote, traditional, if there is one, divorce process. And we all, you know, you see it on TV and the court, you know, court TV, and you have these huge blow ups and everybody's lawyering up and getting in their corners. But Jacob, if you could explain like traditional divorce in America. I mean, what does that mean anything, or am I off base?
Well, I think it does, because a lot of people have this perception that you have, and you know, it is an area that everybody is familiar with, I think, from media and popular culture. But, you know, most people, thankfully, only have to go through it once, and it doesn't come until late in life after you've been exposed to the idea of divorce and the idea of litigation, of a litigated divorce, basically your entire life, and then it's your turn. A lot of people have this perception that you are lawyering up, that lawyers are going to lead this, are going to lead you into court, and you're going to get your say in front of the judge, and the judge is going to be able to decide a fair resolution to the end of your marriage. It is a...
Now, is that, you said a litigated divorce. So explain that for our listeners in case people might not know what litigated divorce means.
Well, litigation is going to court to have your problems resolved. And so anytime we use the term litigated divorce, it means a process that the court is involved in on some level. A litigated divorce begins with the filing of a complaint where you're listing what you would like the judge to do, and that's followed by the other side, your spouse, answering that complaint. And deadlines then are set by the court. You are having hearings. Oftentimes, almost everybody who gets divorced settles their divorce on some level. Even if they're going to the judge finally for some issues, they're settling some aspects of the divorce, and usually that happens before the marriage breaks down. People have an idea of a split of property, for instance,
right,
that they're going to be accepting of, and oftentimes people get there shortly after the complaint is filed.
So each party gets a lawyer, and they begin the process of serving or discovery. You know, there's all these terms that we're going to have to. I guess discovery is gathering information, and
right. So starts with the filing of a complaint, then the answer, which both of those are filed with the court. Then there is a period of time of gathering information and voluntarily exchanging it with the other side. That's discovery in litigation, is finding out what the other person has.
Okay.
And there's certain discovery that is mandated for divorce cases. Whether you have an attorney or you're doing this on your own, as long as you have filed a complaint and an answer, you're going to have to gather records and give them to the other side, sign releases so that they can ask your employer about your benefits, ask your banks for the statements for the past 6 years, whatever it is that they want. Then there are some discovery processes that are not mandated or not automatically a part of a divorce. Those are things that you would generally work on with your attorney to craft questions to answers that you would like answered by the other side. Then you have an option, you have the deposition option, where you're calling them in and putting them in front of a court reporter and having them provide sworn testimony, and you're just able to ask them the questions. Or you have questions that you're submitting to them in writing, and the civil rules call on them to answer that within 30 days.
It's so interesting to me because as you're just talking about these things, just in a, from a factual point of view, this is how we go. Like my anxiety is rising over here. Just like it's so automatically, I feel like there's these two camps and everyone's like wanting this and creating questions. And, you know, it's like no wonder that when we talk about what is traditional divorce in this country, the first thing that pops into your mind is like anger. And, you know, we're each on our own side and our attorney's here with me. And, you know,
yeah,
well, and you're not even talking about it from like an emotional point of view. And I'm already feeling the emotions that go along. That.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, I, for the most part, every other family law attorney doesn't have a lot of emotion for these things. It is an automatic. And then you get, and I mentioned one, you have this release. You have to sign a release that says they can go to your bank and pull all the records and send it out to every bank in the country that says, send me all your, any statements for any person, you know, any account that's connected to this person. For us, it's just an automatic and you know, attorneys who practice in this area, we don't get a lot of heat behind those sort of discovery issues, but they are absolutely extremely stressful for our clients. To go back to the, I'll give you a sort of a general lay it out how far. So we're now into the discovery process and that can take several months. You're assigned a judge right after you filed your complaint and that judge will issue an order. There's a standing domestic relations order that calls on you to not move money around and not cut people off insurance and those sorts of things, not leave state without the kid, without the permission of the other parent. Then that judge will set at some point, either a status conference or a trial setting conference. You will come in front of the judge and you, generally the first question out of the judge's mouth is, so how, where are we at? Which is an indication that the attorneys are supposed to stand up and say, oh, we think we can settle this, or we need to set a trial date, or we've got these discovery issues that are outstanding and you really need to slap their wrist because they're not doing something. You then you would have your trial set, and oftentimes people, when they're speaking to me, want to know, how am I going to have this done by the end of the summer? And the answer is invariably no. If you're going to litigate, you're going to be setting, you're going to be looking at trial generally 6 to 12 months after that trial setting conference. This is just when judges have availability on their calendars. And so if you're waiting for a judge to decide your case, in other words, you're waiting to go to trial, you're going to be waiting for quite a while.
It sounds like there's not any talking between the couple during this process. I mean, there is no, doesn't sound like there's any talk. Like, what is it that you want? What is it that I want? How do we meet the needs of the family?
It's interesting to me because that's what was just coming up for me, just talking about this idea. And I see this all the time as I'm working with divorcing people is, you know, and they've got been given this trial date at 6 to 12 months later. And they're like, how do I figure out how to co-parent for the next 6 to 12 months? No one's told us what to do, right? No one said that we can have this much custody or that much custody. And so, yes, you're right. Not only are they not really talking, but at the same time, they're kind of have this long time period when they have to figure things out for themselves because nothing's been decided yet, right?
And are their lawyers telling them, don't share information, you don't talk to them about, you know, what you're doing? Or, I mean, it seems like it's very adversarial. You get in your corner and you wait.
It certainly,
that's the norm.
It certainly can be adversarial. It depends on the lawyer. It depends on the party. A lot of my part, and I think you said something, Whitney, that's important. They're really not talking. That doesn't mean they're talking. I mean, Prentice, when you said, sounds like people aren't talking, I was going to jump in and say, they're always talking. They're always talking. You can't stop talking to your spouse. Either it's parenting issues or you just want to get that last email out that says, I can't believe you didn't try harder. Whatever it is, there's always communication back and forth between the parties. You raise another issue. Well, what do you do for the 6 months that you're waiting for a trial? And I think 6 months is, I would not tell a client that we could expect a trial in 6 months. You have either then the opportunity to request relief from the judge by way of motion practice. So my client wants the kids on a week on, week off schedule. The other party is keeping the kids and won't let my client see them. I bring my client in. We talk about facts about what makes them a better parent than the other party. We put that into an affidavit. We may be collecting other evidence to put in front of the judge. We file that all with the judge saying, here's why he or she is not, you know, here's why we should get the custody schedule that we want. The judge then is waiting. The other side then has an opportunity to oppose that motion, say, no, judge, you shouldn't give him that relief. The kids are better off with me. Then the filing party has another chance to come in with what's called a reply, which is basically saying, no judge, give us the relief that we want. Then when it's an interim custody issue, generally the court is setting a hearing. And so you're going in for sort of you're going to be putting on evidence. It's a mini trial in some ways, mm-hmm. to try and establish why your view of things should prevail. Putting witnesses on, cross-examination, all the sort of litigation that you would see in TV programs, although much less exciting generally.
All still very time-consuming. And the whole time you have, of course, these children who are, you know, maybe not seeing a parent or don't really know what's going on, and they can tell because they're transitioning back and forth all the time on these weird schedules. And
that's what you and I see.
Right.
Every day. Yes. Is the kids that are coming in, the parents are fighting. And I guess that's essentially what we really want to get to today. The divorce stuff, it's very confusing, and it sounds, you know, the traditional divorce process, I think, to sum it up, it sounds very difficult and very emotionally challenging and difficult for kids and for people, the participants in that.
And time consuming.
Is it fair to say that it's led by the lawyers?
Yes, a litigated divorce is going to be generally led by the lawyers. The parties certainly are usually in the dark on a lot of things. And the question is, do you want to pay me to try to explain to you what it means to be a lawyer? Or do you just want to take care of the issues that need to be taken care of?
And then you present all that information to the judge if it goes a full litigation, and they say, here is what you're going to do with your family, right? And essentially.
I would say that in the process of that, because it is kind of attorney-driven litigation, I have a lot of, you know, individual adult clients I've worked with who are divorcing who, you know, they're feeling such a lack of trust in everyone and everything in their lives. And then they have to trust this attorney that they've hired, and they trust that you guys are doing what you're supposed to be doing. But, you know, they'll often come in and be like, I have no idea what's going on. You know?
Right.
And I hope that I hired the right person because I'm afraid I'm going to lose my kids or I'm going to lose my house. And so there's like this huge trust that goes into that process that also I think is very emotionally charged for people that are in the middle of breaking down a marriage.
Driven by fear and
resentment and anger and anxiety.
Yeah.
And they're trying to now learn how to parent as a single parent in that process as well often, and go to work and all that other stuff that we do as adults.
Life.
Yeah.
All right. Real quickly, for those of you who might be tuning in late, my guests today are Anchorage therapist Whitney Whitman and local family law attorney Jacob Sonneborn. We are discussing the art of divorcing well. I want to remind our listeners that you can reach us with your questions or comments in three ways. Local phone number 550-8433, or you can reach us toll-free from anywhere you might be listening at 1-888-353-5752. The last way to participate is by emailing your questions to lineone@alaskapublic.org. I read a quote by Sir Nicholas Scott, who is the president of the Family Division of the High Court in the UK. So he sounds like a fairly, I don't know him, obviously, but he sounds like a fairly like big guy or important guy. He said, there is nothing worse for most children than for their parents to denigrate each other. Parents simply do not realize the damage they do in their children by the battles they wage over them. Separating parents rarely behave reasonably, although they always believe that they are doing so and that the other party is behaving unreasonably.
You know, I was just talking about this with some parents, this idea that when you're divorcing or you have divorced, you no longer want to be with your spouse, your ex, and your children, they want to be with both of their parents, mm-hmm. and they want to love and like both of their parents. In fact, we all do. I mean, even as adults, even if you've had trouble with a parent, as an adult, you still wish that you hadn't. You still wish you had that parent that you always wanted. It's like we're born wanting that, right?
Absolutely.
And so as soon as one parent badmouths the other, or, you know, creates a tension where they're making the other parent look like they're not good enough or that they're doing something wrong, all it really does for their children is create confusion, because they're confused as to how this other parent that they love and like and want to be with and want to be a part of their lives could not be good enough. And so depending upon their age, that confusion manifests in a whole lot of different ways, but that's what it's doing in a nutshell. And, you know, I would agree with this quote, although I don't know Sir Walter either. but it is really, from a psychological perspective, it's the most troubling thing about divorce. I mean, children are very resilient and they can handle all kinds of transitions, but they cannot compute this idea that one of their parents isn't good enough for them.
Well, it's one thing to be resilient, and it's another thing to be able to stop caring about your parent or to be asked to side with one against the other. Mm-hmm. Like your mom's this awful person and your dad's a, mm-hmm. you know, a real SOB and, mm-hmm. you know, he did this and this and he cheated on. I hear that all the time. Well, it's really destructive. Mm-hmm. And I don't think people really get it. And that was the point of the quote is that they are so entrenched in their own positions and looking at the conflict from their own filters, with their own filters, that they are they believe that they are justified and valid and reasonable, but they're really acting irrationally and emotionally, it seems like, a lot of the time.
And I think often parents want to protect their children from the badness kind
Absolutely.
Of that their other parent has caused, but it doesn't work out that way.
Certainly, we don't want to give the impression that we're saying parents do this on purpose mm-hmm. to hurt their children, because they don't. They really do feel like they are working in the best interest. They're going to be better off with me. Mm-hmm. I know that. Mm-hmm. They're not mm-hmm. going to be okay with their mom who's got this or that, or their dad who drinks too much or has a girlfriend. I don't want them around that girl, right? That's the stuff yeah. that you guys, I'm sure, hear all the time.
You do. It's an oft-repeated line is that, you know, divorce is crazy making. You really, so you say that people, from the quote on, we've been talking about how this is, it's rare that parents don't fall into this trap. And you've got really high functioning, intelligent, wonderful people who do things that in, you know, 6 months prior or 6 years after will not have imagined that they've done, including talking to the kids openly about what is going on, with either an idea that the
right.
kids deserve to know, this is their lives too, all and it's terribly frustrating. I mean, Whitney and I are sitting here nodding along while you read that quote. We've all been nodding along as we've been going on. It's really frustrating to have otherwise rational, high functioning people who just can't stop themselves from exposing their kids to the litigation.
And I think that's like the trauma of divorce, really, is you're working from a place where, you know, you really are experiencing a trauma stress. I mean, as a divorcing adult, so much is changing in your life. So much conflict has suddenly been brought into your life that you're not making rational decisions. And, you know, I know we'll get to this later, but I think that's one of the reasons why we all are so interested in doing divorce differently, because the less traumatic the process is, the more rational you can think along the way. You're grieving. There are actually, you know, serious stages of grief that are going on, before you ever contacted an attorney,
yes.
after you contact the attorney, once the divorce is actually signed and decreed, for years to come. And I'm often talking to parents about the fact that regardless of how they feel about each other, they are going to see each other at the most important events of their lives for the rest of their lives. Graduations, you know, birthdays, wedding celebrations, grandchildren's births. You're going to see this other person at the most important events of your life, you know? And so it's all very traumatic and it's very grief-stricken.
You brought up a great point, Whitney, in one of your emails that you sent to me. You talked about the grandparenting. I mean, essentially, they're going to go from co-parenting to co-grandparenting eventually if they do it well.
Well, there's that. And then actually what I meant in that email was also the idea that the divorcing couple's parents often end up in this horrible position of not seeing their grandchildren. And so the divorcing couple's children often lose their relationship with their grandparents, which from, you know, a health and wellness perspective is very disconcerting. And, grandparents play a huge role or can play a huge role in the best of circumstances. And divorce often becomes an area where grandparents get pushed to the wayside and are no longer active in their grandchildren's lives. So, yes, both of those. But that's what I intended in that email.
Yeah. All right. So shift gears a little bit, and Whitney, you talk a lot about, you've mentioned several times, co-parenting mm-hmm. and creating a co-parenting plan. So, we are Line One for your health, and we want to talk about how does this benefit people's wellness, right? That's the thing we want to get out. How is this going to help people? And I guess from a practical standpoint, Jacob, you mentioned everybody files a divorce, and then they split, and then they go into their corners, and now the waiting starts and they're, going back and forth. And you, Whitney, said in the meantime, they still have to, you know, go to soccer games. And mm-hmm. who's picking up little Johnny on Tuesday at Aurora Kids? The day-to-day kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And is that where the co-parenting piece or the parenting plan mm-hmm. comes into place?
Yes, and much like Jacob was referring to the interim custody earlier. So in a legal process, there will often be an interim custody agreement that lasts until the final custody is decided. And so I think, you know, in collaborative law, we also try to do the same thing. It's like we're working on a more permanent custody or co-parenting plan, but there may have to be some little, you know, temporary agreements that happen just to get through the day to day. And really what I'd like to think of in co-parenting is it's the time sharing plan. You know, we're sharing time with our children. And so how do we do that? How do we do that in a way that prioritizes their needs, their developmental needs, their academic needs, their social and emotional wellness needs? And so that process and how people work through that process plays a big role in how much their children are affected by their divorce. Absolutely.
I would like to think that I would be above all this, you know, in the case of divorce, and you know, but I would suppose that any of the three of us, if we were to go through a divorce, would have a really, really challenging time harnessing those emotions and those angers and that feeling in order to really create an environment that is healthy for our children and for ourselves. Because it's not just about the kids. I mean, that co-parenting plan really takes a lot of pressure off parents as well, doesn't it? I mean, it seems like.
Well, yeah, it does. I mean, I one of the only benefits, I think, to, you know, sharing your time with your children is that on occasion you have a moment to yourself. So, yeah, it can be a positive thing.
So that person could become an ally, really, in a sort of a built-in.
Yeah.
A respite worker.
Yes. Well,
per se.
Or just a chance to have a moment alone.
Mm-hmm. All right. I think we're getting close to our break already, which we're going to run out of time. We have way too much information, which always happens, so we need to move right along. Divorce options. We've talked about collaborative law. We've talked about traditional divorce. Now, there's in the training that I went to, there seems to be a variety of different sort of approaches, and they seem to be sort of, I don't know, tiered in their level of intensity and conflict. Jacob, if you could talk a little bit about some of the different approaches to divorce and what they might entail.
Sure. We had been talking about a traditional litigated divorce, and I think that is, you know, still probably the most common way that a divorce goes down is that you've got a complaint answered or a complaint filed and an answer. And then you just said, and then you're waiting for your trial date. Well, what really happens in the vast majority of cases is you're exchanging a couple of settlement ideas and you're coming up with agreements. That's a mediated settlement, whether it's, and mediation covers a broad spectrum. Mediation, you know, can be two attorneys. It can be just one neutral that doesn't even have to be an attorney.
Now, explain, people aren't going to understand what neutral means. So.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you.
No, that's fine. It happens all the time. We get caught up in our verbiage.
The neutral would be the one person that's in the room to sort of work with the two parties who have disputes to try to get them to an agreement. So that would be the mediator. That would be the person that is sitting there between the two parties trying to help them come up with agreements. But we have, you have options when it comes to ending your marriage. There's a spectrum both of variety and time intensity and cost and stress. I think and they're all independent. And so the kitchen table divorce, where you print the paperwork up from the Alaska court website, sit down and fill it out together to split up your assets, that can take place in a couple hours. That doesn't say how much stress that causes, both not only in the process itself, but also long term. But that's at one end of the spectrum in terms of the time that you'd spend deciding on the end of your marriage is the kitchen table, where there's no professionals involved. It's just the two of you, and you're sitting down and coming up with agreements, and it can take no time at all, or it can take months. Then you've got a situation where one person has hired an attorney. That does not necessarily foreclose the idea that you'd have a kitchen table divorce. You sit down with the person and their attorney now, and that also can take no time or as much time as you like. Then you've got adding professionals sort of to the group. You've both now hired attorneys. I guess before I should get there, I should say one of you hires an attorney and then you go and mediate it. And you have a neutral mediator who acts as the go-between for unrepresented party, person without an attorney, and the party and his or her attorney. Then you got both lawyering up, both people hiring an attorney. Still doesn't foreclose any of the options that have come before. Now, instead of sitting down at the kitchen table with just your spouse, you're sitting down at the conference room table with your spouse and their attorney. Can still be very low stress, very low time, you know, not really time intensive and not hugely expensive. And you start to very quickly get into the real variables that matter here, which are yourself, your spouse, and the attorneys that you both hire. Those are the number one determining factor in terms of how much time you're going to spend and how much money you're going to spend on your divorce and how stressful it's going to be. Because it is always the question, and generally when people come in, one of their questions is, well, how much is it going to cost me and how long is it going to take? And I tell them, you can get this done with in 2 or 3 weeks if you really want to. All you have to do is say yes to everything that they say and we'll get an agreement together.
Right.
We'll put it in front of the judge. Judges love, judges don't get actually the call, but their assistants love getting the call that says, we just filed this divorce. We've got it all settled and ready to go. Can you find us a time on your calendar to put the settlement on the record? That is where you go and stand up, raise your right hand, swear to tell the truth, and then say, yes, I agree. And here's our agreement. Judges will schedule that within judges' assistants again will schedule that within a week. I called on one a month ago and they said, do you have time this afternoon? I mean, they are happy to have you come in. They spend 30 minutes and they get a case all done with. But again, to go back to my point, you can decide how much you spend on your divorce.
So what you're saying is that two reasonable people could sit down really with maybe an attorney or two and in a matter of a week or so, say what's best for you, and let's what's best for our kids, and let's work to make this, just as we joined in marriage, mm-hmm. we may separate and divorce and do it well with everybody's best interests at heart. Got to take a break now, but when we come back, we are going to go right into the collaborative law thing because we are flying right along here. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. Our local number is 550-8433. You can also reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752 and email us at lineone@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we will continue our conversation with our guest, attorney Jacob Sonneborn and therapist Whitney Whitman. I'm Prentice Pemberton.
You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line One, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcast of Line One, Your Health Connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your guest host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're joining us late, I have in studio Anchorage therapist Whitney Whitman and local attorney Jacob Sonneborn. Our topic today is divorcing well. You can email questions to lineone@alaskapublic.org, call locally at 550-8433, or toll free at 1-888-353-5752. Please remember if you are listening between 7 and 8 p.m. On Monday evening, you will be hearing a taped recording. At the break, Whitney brought up an interesting question and one that I didn't have on my talking points, and maybe we should take just a couple of seconds to talk about that. She asked, what happens if I can't afford an attorney? How do I go through this process as I said, Jacob costs about $5 an hour to hire him. So what if I can't afford that and I need to get a lawyer? And what if my partner has a bazillion dollars, mm-hmm. and they have, you know, the guy up on the top tower of whatever big building we have here in Anchorage with the big fancy law firm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, those are two separate questions. Mm-hmm. The first is, and I'll address each.
They probably can't be answered today, but briefly.
Well, if you cannot afford an attorney, you're either doing the kitchen table dissolution that you find the paperwork online, or you're filing the complaint on your own. If you've been served with a complaint, you're filing the answer on your own. You're showing up to court. You're telling the judge, you're answering that question that the judge asks, how's everything going? You're answering that question. You're, you know, responsible for filing your own motions. You're responsible for choosing your own trial date. All those things become your responsibility. Even at $5 an hour, people who can afford it, they figure out that it makes sense to pay somebody else to do all these things rather than do it themselves. Second question now is, if you've got the person you have one spouse who can afford an attorney and the other who can't, that's an attorney's fees question. Generally, the lower income spouse is able to get attorney's fees to correct exactly what you were sort of getting at. You can't have a system that's set up that the person that has access to all the money is able to railroad the other person by hiring three or four attorneys and going to trial against somebody who is unrepresented. So the courts, the trial court will, on a motion of a party, make a determination of how best to level the playing field if it's necessary, and order one party to pay the other party's fees up front or at the end of trial.
Because I think what Whitney and I hear all the time is, I have a lot of, particularly, I don't want to say it's only women, but mostly women, it seems like, come in and they're like, I'm stuck. He makes, you know, $250,000 a year, and I'm at home for the last 10 years, and I don't have any, or 20 years, and I don't have any way to support myself after this. He's going to take the kids. Mm-hmm. I'm going to get nothing. I'm going to be home. I mean, that's the fear. Tremendous anxiety.
Or I see clients who they can't afford. Neither of them can afford attorneys. And we are, I don't know if this is true around the nation, because I only really know Alaskan stuff, but we do have a family law help center here that, I mean, even though it's the worst of situations to try to be representing yourself in court, they have classes and they will help walk you through the process. And I really don't think anyone could do it without that help.
Okay, that's the Family Law Help Center.
Am I right about the name?
Yes, yeah. You're right about the name. And all of the, you know, the number one resource for folks who cannot afford an attorney is the court website. The Family Law Help Center has a link right off of the front page of the Alaska. If you just do an internet search for Alaska courts, the Alaska court website will come up, and there's a link right on the front page to the Family Law Help Self-Help Center. Mm-hmm. And it has, you know, reams of forms and everything online that allows you to do this yourself. But again,
it's very overwhelming.
I'm getting stressed out right now.
It's completely overwhelming. I would also just point out that there are some other alternative dispute resolution programs, some ideas that are being have been put into effect by the court system. One is called the Early Resolution Project. Myself and a number of other attorneys in town volunteer occasionally to go down to court and help people who have filed a complaint for a divorce and both parties are unrepresented, to give them a little bit of free counsel, with the idea that we can oftentimes we can get these things settled just with 3 or 4 hours of attorney time, because people do not know what the right answer is. They don't know. And the big question is, well, what will a judge do? And if you can give people a universe of possibilities, you've got a closed universe. The court is not going to order that the kids are going to spend every night with you, unless, you know, you can prove that your spouse is burning the kids with cigarettes. Mm-hmm. You're not going to get them 100% of the time. So when people get that sort of talk from a family law attorney, oftentimes they can settle it. But there's no opting into that program. That's just something you're filing your own divorce and hoping that you get a notice that says, show up on such and such a Friday for your early resolution project appearance.
All right, those are good resources. Thanks. It sounds like a lot of that is mostly fear, those concerns, and that there really are resources and options out there for people who can't necessarily afford it. And nobody really has to be stuck in a really bad marriage, and that people who do feel like they're stuck, if they do a little research and ask questions and look around, that they can probably find some support. And go ahead.
Well, just to give another plug to a local group that I work with occasionally, the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, okay. also provides attorneys. I volunteer, so through ANDVSA, and if they have if a party has been suffering from domestic violence or is a victim of domestic violence, they can get through this program and get lined up with an attorney. Not every case obviously gets an attorney, but oftentimes you can get an attorney who does your case for free through that network. So that's another good resource.
Great. Got an email here. It says, my parents divorced when I was 12, and the most traumatic thing that occurred was that our parents made us the messengers. Mm-hmm. Please speak directly to your spouse. That's what that's what she says.
That's such a common occurrence, and it can vary from anything which seems benign, like tell your father it's his turn to pick you up at soccer this week, to, you know, slewing a bunch of insults that you should tell your father or mother. And I think the more benign one is probably what's a little bit trickier, actually. It's very important that the parents are still parenting. It's not your child's job to be communicating to the other parent what their parenting role is. And what that does in the worst of circumstances, other than maybe build some resentment, you know, in your kid, is it also parentifies them. And what that term means is it makes your kid grow up a whole lot quicker than they really ought to grow up. And so they end up taking on responsibilities and just even having to be aware of responsibilities that one would hope, you know, a child could not have to think about in their childhood, because they're going to have a whole lifetime of being a responsible adult, hopefully. And so I think that's the one to watch. You know, a lot of people aren't slinging insults at their ex necessarily through their kids, but they are putting their kids in positions to have to, you know, be a co-parent, basically.
And tell your father he has to pick you up at 3 o'clock at soccer practice because I'm going to be out with someone.
And because I don't talk to your father.
Right.
And so the other hidden message there is, you know, I don't respect your other parent, and I refuse to get on the phone with them even for you. That's the hidden message there. You and your well-being, my child, you're not important enough for me to get over whatever it is that I have with your other parent.
You are secondary to my anger.
Yes, to my anger and my resentment, all of that stuff, my hurt, my grief. And it's not that the child necessarily, depending upon their age, is conscious of that silent message, but rather that's what they carry with them, especially younger children, you know, prior, you know, all the way up to like preteen and very young adolescence. It's not a conscious thing. They are just carrying that. And that really affects your self-esteem. That really affects your sense of self-worth. It affects your ability to have healthy relationships with your friends, with possible significant others as you age. It's very detrimental to a child's sense of self to be parentified in that way, and then also to be given the silent message that you're not important enough for me to get over my own stuff.
It's very important. Another email says, just more of a comment. It would seem that disillusions would be a better choice for reasonable couples. In my case, this worked for myself and husband and child, and we did do it at the kitchen table. Litigation would have been the last resort for me.
Yeah, that's great news. I mean, yeah. I think it works. And I think we don't hear a lot about that because they're at the kitchen table, right? So Jacob and I don't ever see them, right? And their kid is well adjusted because obviously they were able to, you know, talk together at the kitchen table. So
I would just go to something you said before, though. I mean, first of all, absolutely. I don't see the really good divorces. I see the ones where people have at least some question about whether or not they're on the right track. But you get a situation oftentimes with something you described where people feel stuck. They feel like they don't have any options. And to sit down at the kitchen table with somebody who is domineering and controlling and is going to force you to come up with a determination, it's great when it works. You can be as reasonable and rational as possible. It doesn't guarantee that the person sitting across from you is gonna take the same tack. And oftentimes people feel like, well, it's far too expensive. I just want to get it over with. If we just get this filed, everything will calm down and he or she will leave me alone.
It takes two people to make a good marriage. I suppose it takes two people to make a good divorce.
And it takes two people to parent really well.
I'd like to take a caller now. We have a call from Nancy. You're on the air with Whitney and Jacob.
Hi. Yeah. I when I was younger, I had a marriage that with a man I didn't want to be married to anymore, and he did not want to have a divorce. And I ended up doing filing for a notice to absent spouse through the newspaper, and I finally went to court alone and got divorced of him. So that's an option, too, for people that if they can't talk to their spouse or whatever about getting separated or divorced, that's an option that I would like to put on the table for people.
Thank you, Nancy.
Well, yeah, Nancy, I would just point out that you whether you know it or not, you did file a complaint for a divorce. The whole question, it sounds like, was could you get your husband served? Did you know where he was, and was he responding? And
I talked to him, and he didn't want to be divorced, and I wanted to be divorced. And I said, well, this is what I found out. I can file this paperwork. And he said, well, I won't sign anything. I go ahead and do it. And, yeah, I paid the fee. Back then it was like $100 or something, and so it was a done deal.
No, it absolutely is an option if somebody is refusing to cooperate to just go ahead and proceed yourself, because the court system is set up to deal with people who don't answer complaints and don't participate, and that is to give you basically a default judgment and say you're divorced.
So
right, and I think it had to be published for 4 weeks or something in a local newspaper where I thought he was living, and so that is an option for some people.
All right. Thanks for the comment, Nancy.
Thank you, Nancy.
Thank you.
That brings up an interesting question for me. What if somebody doesn't want to get divorced? What if they say, no, I'm not divorcing you. We're going to stay married forever. Forever.
Tough.
They can get divorced without...
We have a no-fault state. You don't have to prove anything to get a divorce other than you have an irreconcilability of differences such that the two of you cannot remain married. And all you have to do is stand up and say, I don't get along with this person. And the judge will say, I've heard enough, and give you your divorce. So some jurisdictions, you still have to prove fault, but it's not the case in Alaska.
Not in Alaska. All right. We're down, unfortunately. We've got about 10 minutes. We could do a whole show on the effects on children, and I think it's super important, and we've touched on it just briefly, because I know kids have all sorts of problems academically, socially, long-term depression, anxiety stuff. Give me just a quick little one-minute spiel on some of the effects of divorce on children, or on difficult divorces on children.
Well, you know, it's fairly age related as well, but I'm not even sure where to start in 1 minute. I feel like
okay, you can have two. I mean,
I think one of the biggest effects of divorce on children when it's not going well is that children end up making bad decisions about themselves and about the way that they are going to be in the world, because they don't feel very supported, and they don't, you know, feel like they have that network of people to kind of, you know, stand beside them and say, hey, you know, we're here with you. You know, often, especially if it's happening right then and there, that divorce process that Jacob was talking about that could take 6 months, a year, 18 months, maybe longer. During that time, everyone's so frazzled that the kids can often get kind of lost in the wayside. You know, teenagers will become very manipulative because there's space for that. And that's actually a teenager's developmental job, is to test limits and manipulate and see how that works. And
absolutely.
And so that's a very unfortunate aspect of them doing what's normal for them, but yet not having the structure and kind of the systematic response to them testing those limits. Younger kids will often, you know, suffer academically. Like you said, their sleep will be affected. You know, high-risk behaviors will start as preteens and on into adolescent, experimenting with, you know, drugs and alcohol and sex and new relationships. And it really just comes back to what I was talking about earlier, which is self-esteem and self-worth and how much that's impacted by a very conflictual divorce and the length of time that conflict goes on.
A conflictual divorce can increase lots of risks for future problems.
Absolutely.
In adolescence, yes. And into adulthood.
Yeah.
All right, collaborative divorce process.
Yeah, let's talk,
let's talk about it. Let's get into it real quick and see. Go ahead and start. Explain it. Just sort of the
right.
Overview.
So, sorry, Prentice. I'd talked about this before when it was first started. The idea was: is it possible to remove the court? Because it was identified that this having this fallback of, well, I can always go get this judge to decide my case for me. The attorneys in the lower 48 who set this process up, and certainly our experience up here and everywhere, has borne that out, that it's very, very hard to get people to really focus on the interests of the other party. If you feel like I'm going to be able to go and speak to this person in a black robe and they're going to hear me and they're going to give me the right decision, I don't need to deal with this person. I don't need to deal with them because I have somebody who will make those decisions for me. So the way that the collaborative process works is, you both have attorneys. you and your attorney enter into an agreement, a retainer agreement, that says, I, as your attorney, will sit in the room with you, and I will support you, and I will try to reach a settlement of your divorce, but I will not ever go into court with you unless we are putting a final settlement on the record. And so basically, if people who have started the collaborative process determine that they want to leave the table and try to work and litigate their divorce, they're going to have to hire new counsel. So it creates some motivation for people to remain when the going gets tough, to remain in the room and trying to settle their divorce. And I think that is the hallmark of the collaborative divorce, is that you have a participation agreement that says you have to fire your attorney if you want to litigate. The other hallmark of the collaborative process is what we call four-way or five-way meetings or six-way meetings, which are those sitting at the table meetings. All aspects of your divorce settlement are going to be discussed in the presence of the other party. And then I made reference to a five or a six-member, six-way meeting. Professionals are added to the team. You start off with at least four people in the room in every meeting. And oftentimes somebody like Whitney is added as a child specialist or as a mental health neutral or as a coach to one party or the other or as a neutral mediator. And then we also have financial folks that are in the group with us. And those people are added to handle the spreadsheet, handle the finances, speak to these folks about what distributions of their property might work best. But the idea is we are all going to sit down together, and we are not going to resort to the courtroom to decide our disputes. We're going to do it. The parties themselves are going to do it with the assistance of these other folks in the room.
And the financial person and the mental health neutral, for lack of a better term, we are both neutral. Those two parties are neutral. So, when I'm acting as a mental health neutral, I see myself as kind of a mediator of the team as well. Like I'm helping the team process function well. I'm creating agendas even. I'm making sure everyone's communicating with each other. Excuse me. The financial professionals are also neutral. We're not, taking any sides here. Our whole goal is to come up with a mutual agreement and a mutual settlement between the two parties. And so the attorneys, I think it's pretty important to mention too that when the two attorneys are both collaborative attorneys. So, I can't go hire Jacob and then my husband go hire an attorney that's never done any collaborative work. The attorneys have to be a part of the Alaskan Association of Collaborative Professionals, as do I as a mental health professional, as does the financial professional. So that we've all got a training and a background in collaborative law and often sometimes even know each other. And so we try to create teams that function well because the clients really have to trust the team. They have to trust that we have their best interest in mind. They have to trust that we're going to walk them through the process because it's still a difficult process. Even though we're not walking into court and we don't have all those expectations that a court would have, there's still a lot that's going on. And I definitely think that the trust in the team and the way the team functions is what makes also the process successful.
Jacob mentioned transparency.
Yeah.
In my understanding in collaborative law, everything is on the table. There's not hiding. There's not, yep. I mean, everything financial, mm-hmm. Any sort of extra land, everything's on the table. The attorneys don't keep secrets.
Right.
There is attorney privilege. But and they are to advise their clients as to their rights under the law, but then they say, what do you want to do?
Yes, and that's the beauty of the collaborative process is that you get to create your divorce. You get to create your settlement.
There's, drive the bus.
Yes, and I think sometimes that might be the transition that people have to make when they do decide to go with the collaborative process is they often are looking to the rest of us because they have anywhere from 2 to 4 to 5 professionals in the room. And so they often look to us like, well, what's next? And I think that's the biggest transition for
right.
people who decide this is that we turn back to them and say, well, what do you want to be next?
Right.
And that's often a little troubling maybe sometimes, but it's in the end a really beautiful process.
I want to see if we can get Bob's phone call in real quick. Bob, do you got a quick question for us?
Well, I just have my wife and I came up with a very unique way of getting divorced. And I said, wife, not ex-wife. The reason being is before we got married, we both agreed to hire our own attorneys and fight out a divorce to create a living document as to who would get what in the event of a future divorce.
Huh.
That way we did it while we still loved each other. We didn't, you know, this adversarial thing. I know to the penny, to the slice of bread, who's going to get what if we were to get divorced tomorrow.
Well, has that changed over the years? I mean, as you guys have acquired new assets? Or I mean, so you go back and you edit your living document?
That's why I said living document. Uh-huh. Once a month, we go in and edit that document. Yeah, if we purchase something, we sell something, you know, whatever.
That's really interesting. Thank you, Bob, for that call. That's an interesting way to look at it. I like it. It goes right to the collaborative approach where you're interest-based negotiations. Mm-hmm. You're talking about what is in not only my interest, but your interest and how in our children's interest.
Yes.
And that's kind of that's the focus. So that's a great call. Unfortunately, I have about a minute and a couple minutes left.
This goes by fast.
It goes by real fast, and it always gets away from me. Anything on the collaborative law process that really needs to be spoken to? I think we touched on some of the highlights of it.
We did spend, unfortunately, sort of radio imitates life, and we spent a lot of time talking about traditional litigated divorce and how difficult it can be. And the collaborative process is sort of a new process relative to certainly to litigated divorce. It has too many advantages to sort of to knock out in 1 minute. It does allow, though, for, you know, its goal is a divorce that works, and it has advantages like privacy that you do not have in litigated divorce, and that's a big one. I mean, if somebody is in court and litigating something, every piece of evidence that they have is public record. So I was talking way back about that affidavit that I helped the person prepare. That's public record. Anybody can go down and pull that out of the court record and see what exactly you think about your spouse. And whether it's those sorts of comments or whether it's why a business is valuable or not valuable, those are important pieces of information that a lot of people would prefer to keep private. This is another big advantage of the collaborative is that everything that happens in that room stays in that room and cannot be used in litigation down the road. It's a totally transparent process, but also protected by the confidentiality that everybody signs off on.
Whitney?
I think from my perspective, obviously, it's about the children. I mean, that's why I got into this work, because it allows us to be proactive instead of, you know, trying to clean up the mess that's been made in the family when everyone was acting dysfunctionally and thinking irrationally. We're working from the get-go to make sure that the children are prioritized, their developmental needs are prioritized, their health and wellness, social, emotional, and everyone feels better for that, I think.
Kurt Cobain said, "I had a really good childhood up until I was 9. Then a classic case of divorce really affected me." My thanks to today's guests, Jacob Sonneborn and Whitney Whitman. If you would like to continue today's conversation, join KSKA on Facebook. You can find the link at our website, alaskapublic.org, and you can let us know your thoughts about today's show at our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We welcome any and all feedback and are especially interested in hearing your thoughts on subject of interest for the monthly mental health segment of Line 1. Why not tune into Your Health next week, April 1st, when Dr. Woodard and his guests will be discussing the risks and benefits, as well as two recent Alaskan outbreaks of illness associated with eating raw, unpasteurized dairy product. Pak Yak is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor, audio engineer for today's show. Thanks for listening. I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.